I call to order the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Thursday, February 18th. First on the agenda is Representative Kahn with House File 2757. Representative Kahn, please come to the table. Bring your testifier to the table. Members, we don't yet have a quorum, so we're going to have Representative Kahn present the bill as her testifier needs to get back to teach class. So welcome to the committee. Representative Kahn, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm just going to brief. This was a decision that came out from, it was interesting because it was a charge brought by a county attorney. It was appeal. The district court ruled against the county attorney. The appeals court held it up, and it was then turned down, voted down by the Supreme Court. And what got me involved in this, and I know it's kind of backwards, but I'm going to let Mr. Jones do most of the explanation of it. What got me so irritated about this was reading the dissent, a fabulous 29-page dissent by Justice Paul Anderson on the Supreme Court decision, and I usually get angry on all kinds of issues. This angered me because I've been trained in my background before I got into the legislature was as a scientist with serious classes in chemistry and serious understanding of what things like concentration meant. And this was just such a violation of an understanding of matter, you know, such a fundamental thing that that's where my irritation with the decision came. But let me turn to someone who can do a better job than I can in explaining it.
Welcome, Professor Samsel Jones. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then go ahead.
My name is Ted Samsel Jones. I'm a criminal law professor at William Mitchell College of Law just down the road. Thank you very much for having me. I'm here today to urge you to pass the bill that would overrule the decision that Representative Kahn just mentioned, the decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State versus Peck. Peck ruled that bong water counts as a mixture for the purposes of Chapter 152, and thus that the weight of bong water counts toward the weight of the drugs against the defendant. The opinion in Peck made national headlines, and the national coverage presented the case as kind of a joke. The headlines said things like, Minnesota Supreme Court says that bong water is a drug, and that's somewhat funny because everyone knows that bong water is not, in fact, a drug. But jokes aside, the opinion has very serious consequences. It allows small-time drug users to be punished as major dealers, and it gives prosecutors the vast amount of discretion to decide to treat someone as either a major offender or minor offender based on arbitrary factors. Now, as a legal matter, I think that Peck was wrongly decided. I think that Justice Paul Anderson's dissent was correct. But one of the good things about the criminal law is that it's ultimately up to you. It's ultimately up to the legislature. In Peck, what the court was doing was simply trying to determine what you meant when you wrote the law in the first place. But regardless of whether the court's determination was correct, it's ultimately up to you to clarify your intent. And so I'd urge you to take that opportunity. And I'd urge you to say that bong water is not a drug. And to see why, let me just give you a simple hypothetical. Imagine two people, Jack and Jill, who are both marijuana users. They both go purchase a small amount of marijuana for personal use, say a quarter ounce. And they both go home and smoke it. Jack uses a regular marijuana pipe without any kind of filter, and Jill uses a water bong, which uses water as a filter. Now, reasonable people can disagree about how much they should be punished. Some people think that what they did is very serious, that we shouldn't condone marijuana use, that they should be punished severely. Some people think that it's not a big deal, that they shouldn't be punished very much, or maybe even not at all. But regardless of how much they should be punished, I think everyone should agree that they should be punished the same amount. They should be punished the same amount because their conduct was identical in all relevant respects. Jill used a slightly different kind of pipe, but that doesn't make her conduct any more culpable. Water bongs are not any more dangerous. They don't make the drug any more addictive or any more powerful. So there's no reason to punish their use any more severely than someone who uses some other means to smoke marijuana. But under the Supreme Court's decision in Peck, these two people, Jack and Jill, are treated differently. They can be treated very differently. Jack would probably be guilty of a petty misdemeanor, whereas Jill would probably be guilty of a felony. And when it comes to methamphetamine use, that's the other drug where water bongs are most frequently used, the differences become even more severe. And that's what we saw in Peck. where someone who may have been a small-time user ended up, as a result of the weight of the bong water being counted toward the total drug weight, ended up being charged with and potentially liable for a controlled substances offense in the first degree, which carries a maximum sentence of 30 years and a presumptive sentence for a first-time offender of 7 years. Now again, some people might argue that even small-time users deserve those kinds of serious sentences. But that's really a separate debate. Whether a user gets a sentence like that shouldn't depend on an arbitrary fact, such as whether they happen to use a bong. And that's what Peck gets wrong. The most fundamental principle of criminal sentencing is the principle of proportionality. Proportionality simply means that similar crimes should get similar punishments, and that more serious crimes should get bigger punishments than lesser crimes. That's what Peck messes up. What Peck messes up is that it violates the principle of proportionality in sentencing for drug offenses. Now, I'd just like to add one more final and somewhat more minor point, but a point that was important in the Supreme Court's opinion. Part of the court's opinion was based on its assertion that drug users can drink bong water, and thus that bong water can become part of the drug. That's very misleading, and in most cases, it's basically false. Now, in the case of marijuana, you essentially cannot drink bong water to get high because the active ingredients in marijuana are not water-soluble, at least for all practical purposes. Now, meth is admittedly a little bit different because meth is water-soluble. So at least theoretically, you can drink it. And if there are trace amounts, if there's enough meth in water, of course, you can get high. You could take a standard amount of meth and just mix it with water and drink it. People don't typically do that, but it's at least possible. Just remember in the case of bong water that the whole reason that people use bongs in the first place is to let the drugs come through while filtering out other things, other impurities. It's like a cigarette filter. Drinking bong water is the equivalent of eating a cigarette filter. Now, I'm sure that there are people in the world, desperate, crazy people, who have eaten cigarette filters in the past. And I know that there are people in the world who occasionally drink bong water. But just the fact that some people might do that occasionally is no reason to treat thousands of small-time users like kingpins just because they happen to use a bong. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Questions from members? Seeing none, members, we do have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And Representative Kahn, I will move that House File 2757 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. And it's my understanding that you have an amendment. And is that the DE1 amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to speak to that amendment at all?
I would like to have Mr. Diebel speak to it.
Okay. Mr. Diebel, is it possible for you to speak to the DE1 amendment? Here. Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, the DE1 amendment is an attempt to narrow the scope of Representative Kahn's original proposal. The language places a cross-reference in the key definition of mixture, which was at the focal point of the Supreme Court decision. And the cross-reference is to three subdivisions within the drug code. And those all relate to possession offenses. And the additional new language in those subdivisions expressly excludes the use of bong water or water pipe or any other water use of a controlled substance filtration device from being considered in the weight of the drug for charging decisions. So it's a narrowing of the scope of the original Kahn proposal to focus in specifically on the holding in the Peck case, which had to do with bong water.
All right. And the chair moves the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the panel, my name is Scott Hersey. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I would like to testify in opposition to this particular bill. The issue is whether, as I understand the amendment, the bill will be amended to require a purity analysis for drugs of first, second, and third degrees. And we are opposed to that. This has been reviewed by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and we're strongly opposed to that. I suspect there may be a fiscal note that will accompany this particular bill, and I would submit that that will be dramatic. That will significantly increase the workload of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Laboratory. I would submit that it will almost double their workload in the sense that you will not only require the analysis to determine the type of drug, but you will also require the analysis now to determine the purity. And so we are talking about significantly more resources required for the BCA lab, not only by personnel, but also by equipment. Additionally, some information from the lab, and I believe the lab director is here present today, they are not now set up to do purity analyses for liquid. They could eventually do that, but it would require a significant effort, and they would require significant testing to determine the scientifically valid methods of doing that. In addition, there would be a substantial impact at the local level, both for governments and for public defenders' offices and private defense attorneys. There would be a battle of the experts if we're going to do purity analyses, which is not well defined in the statute, to determine how pure the drug actually is. And anyone who's ended up in a battle of the experts at the trial level or pretrial level knows that it's very expensive. Experts can run $200, $300, $400 an hour with significant preparation time and then the time in court. And like plumbers, they charge portal to portal. You don't just pay the mileage, and the bills will rack up rather rapidly. We believe there could be a significant backlog at the BCA if this were required, and we're opposed to that. And this, as it is proposed, would deal with first, second, and third degree drugs. They're going to deal with drugs that are significantly stepped on, as it's referred to, that is, drugs that may have a high purity at the distribution level. They are diluted with what's called cut and then sold at the street level. And we are concerned that if, in fact, these purity requirements are made, again, we will have a battle of the experts. And these are the singlest largest category of crimes that we have in the Dakota County Attorney's Office, and I suspect throughout the state. There appear to be three parts to the bill. One has to do with purity, dealing with residue, and there's no definition in this statute of residue. There is not an existing definition in statutes. That would cause significant problems in the implementation of this bill. Additionally, yes, I'm referring to the amendment as well as the original point of the bill. If the point is to make it illegal to possess drugs, and that point is to prevent people from ingesting them, it makes sense to prosecute cases that do involve residue. And essentially, by requiring a purity analysis, that would throw up significant roadblocks to both police officers and prosecutors so that they would have a difficult time with these particular cases. The number of those cases would clearly go down simply because they're more expensive, they would be more difficult to prosecute, and in many of the residue cases, that is the mechanism for getting the people who are drug addicts into the system. Many times, for the first-time drug offenders, they get a 15218, which is essentially a stay of adjudication. They are required to go through a treatment program, and they are placed on probation to assure that they don't continue using. That works to their benefit, and if they successfully complete probation, the matter is simply dismissed. And if we have a situation here with this particular bill, it makes it extremely expensive and very difficult to prosecute those cases. Those people will go without treatment and will continue with an addiction that is just devastating on a personal level. As to the provision that deals with the bong water itself and exempting that, that also is a problem. As the scientists can tell you, methamphetamine, for instance, is a precipitate of a liquid. When meth is cooked originally, it is made in a liquid form and then precipitated out into either a cake or a powder form. And if there is a complete exemption for bong water, which again is not really defined particularly in the statute, that could open the door for any clever dealer or manufacturer or cooker of meth to leave their methamphetamine in a liquid form because it's exempted by the statute. It might be noted that there is one decision out there, one reported decision that I'm aware of that the professor pointed out being the Peck decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court. If there is a concern of there being a rash of cases involving water that may contain a controlled substance, we haven't seen them. This is the only reported decision that I'm aware of. And I might point out that that particular decision after, or that case, once it had been decided by the Supreme Court, resulted in a settlement at the trial level of a fifth-degree controlled substance crime, which is the lowest level of a felony crime. So it was treated appropriately when it arrived at the dispositional level. I would submit that the appellate decision was more a matter of separation of powers between the executive and the judicial branch, but the ultimate result was an appropriate one with a fifth-degree controlled substance plea. So we would ask the committee not to vote in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions from members? Professor Samsel Jones, if you come back to the table. Either for the author of the bill or for Professor Samsel Jones, do you believe that requiring the actual weight of the control substance contained in the mixture required would require a significant more amount of scientific evidence or expert testimony, which was just spoken about from the County Attorneys Association? Professor Samsel Jones?
Yeah, I think the original bill would have required a lot of work and would have been more problematic. And so I think the recent amendment, which narrows it so substantially, it's really not going to affect very many cases. And I think this is a work in progress, and I think there are reasonable issues to debate about how to draft this provision. And I think we may not quite be there yet in what we need to do with getting the wording right to make sure that the scope of it is clear and the scope of it is appropriately narrow. In other words, the mixture rule itself, I don't think, is necessarily at issue. I mean, that's a big question, whether you should use the mixture rule when you're measuring drug weights. The only question here, really, about PEC is even assuming the mixture rule is a good thing, whether bong water should count as part of a mixture. And I think what's sensible to do is just say that bong water, all other drug cases are left alone. So when you have cocaine, say, cut with lactose, you don't have to figure out purity. But when you're using water solely as a filtration device, which is what bongs do, not water as part of the meth cooking process, but as a filtration device for ingestion, that water shouldn't count as a mixture. And I think if you wanted to say, well, let's at least measure out how much meth is in the bong water, that's fine. I mean, that would be maybe, what, a small handful of cases a year where the BCA would have to test water to determine how much meth is actually contained. That, to me, does not seem very burdensome. So I think that an appropriately narrow bill would not add very much additional burden to the BCA or to prosecutors' offices.
Okay. Questions from members? Seeing none, with that, I would encourage the County Attorneys Association to get together with Representative Kahn. The Supreme Court said the legislature should look at this, and the legislature's looking at this. And with that, I will lay over House File 2757 for possible inclusion in a public safety policy bill. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
All right, next on the agenda is House File 2701, Representative Adkins.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Representative Adkins. Where does this go? Representative Adkins, it's my understanding you'd like this to go to the General Register. Is that correct?
It is.
All right. Representative Bingham moves that House File 2701 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You recall that last year this bill came before this committee. It was a much more significant change to the law last year, dealt with certification of firefighters. Since passage last year, overwhelmingly, we found that there was a need for a technical change with respect to how we define firefighters so that we're not requiring that folks engaged simply in fire prevention be certified and go through all of the training that was required for the licensure. With that clarification in the that's before you, I'm here with Mr. Thornburg from the professional firefighters to answer any questions, but otherwise that's about all there is to it. We'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Adkins. Is there any questions from the committee? Would you like to state anything for the record in support of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Really all this is many fire departments have a fire prevention bureau, and those folks aren't necessarily engaged in firefighting. And the way the wording of the bill was, or is, or the law is if a chief of a department wanted to hire somebody just to be a fire inspector, the way the law is now, they'd have to also fall under the firefighter, and that isn't necessary for a fire inspector. So this just clarifies it more what a firefighter does and what what type of a person would need to be, a firefighter would need to be licensed, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an inspector.
Thank you. And if you could state your name, title.
I'm sorry. My name's Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters.
Thank you. Anybody in the audience like to testify in favor or in opposition to the bill?
All right, Representative Bigham renews her motion that House File 2701 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Adkins, I believe you have another bill. I will move that House File 2950 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With due respect to the Public Safety Committee, I think most of the issues are relative to disclosure and are commerce-related. This is before this committee, though, because there is a default penalty for a misdemeanor. If they don't comply with the disclosure requirements, it involves the sale of concert and event tickets at large venues of over 1,000 seats, and simply requires that if you're going to make tickets for sale, so you got some concert or sporting event, and there's 15,000 tickets, if only 1,000 of those tickets are actually on sale to the public, that you simply disclose that. We've been at this for a couple of years, just trying to make it a little bit more transparent in terms of what's really going on, so that the average fan knows whether or not they have a chance at buying a ticket or not. This is merely disclosure. It's nothing more than that. We're not looking at putting anybody in jail over it or anything like that. It's simply asking that they identify how many tickets are actually for sale and how many are held back.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 2950 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next is House File 2888. Representative Bigham moves that House File 2888 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here with Representative Morrow, and I don't know if Representative Garofalo is in the area either, but this is a bipartisan and bi-geographical bill. This is the same bill that last year, with the exception of we didn't do the cancellation of license, and what this does is it establishes a gross misdemeanor penalty for anyone who causes the death of another for carelessly or heedlessly driving. Right now, the current statute says that if there is gross, if you can prove gross negligence, it's a felony, otherwise it's a misdemeanor, and there are a lot of people that believe that that is not the misdemeanor penalty is not enough for the justice. That's all I have on the bill. I do have some folks in the audience that, if you want them to testify, we're more than happy to, but just because this was heard last year, Madam Chair, I was trying to save time, and also if Representative Morrow would like to add a couple comments.
No, Madam Chair, the committee has already heard this bill before, and I would appreciate the committee's support.
All right.
I would appreciate the committee's support as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bigham and Representative Morrow, how do you see this bill, how do you see this as it comes before a justice, a judge ruling on this? What do you sense his decision will be? Will he follow through?
Representative Bigham or Representative Morrow?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, what I would anticipate a judge would do is look at the totality of the facts and determine sentencing accordingly. This would allow this middle position between not being able to do anything at all or putting the prosecution in a very difficult position of trying to prove gross negligence. When an accident resulting in death is not alcohol or controlled substance related, it's very difficult to do.
All right. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. For either Representative Bingham or Representative Morrow, as I understand it,
this bill would say, I'll give you an example, a person runs a red light and it's a petty misdemeanor, or according to current 169, could be a careless driving as well. But in this instance, say a separate situation where a person runs a red light and strikes and kills a motorist, providing they're both accidents, there are two separate penalties for essentially the same action based on the result of the accident. Can you think of another law on our books that does that?
Who would like that? Representative Morrow.
I'm sorry, Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I was just bringing Representative Garofalo up to speed as to where we were in the committee as well. But yeah. I think it was your question, do we have other situations in which the...
Let me read quickly, if I can, Madam Chair, Representative Morrow. What this bill does is, based on the result mm-hmm. of the crime, it gives separate penalties or separate violations. And I can't think of another law on our books that does that based on the result. I mean, in cases, you run the red light or you don't run the red light and you're guilty of that because that's the action. But in this case, we've got you run the red light or you don't run the red light, and if there's a result from that, we have a separate penalty. And I can't think of another law on our books that does that.
I think we're all three of us.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, the wonderful assistant Dakota County Attorney, just made me aware that there is assault, criminal vehicular homicide, are two other areas.
But Representative Lesch.
If I could, those, as you know, I read them, they're elements in the crime. Obviously, this would be included in the jury instruction, but I'd be very interested in seeing how a jury instruction would be written in this way. And the reason for that, Madam Chair, is, you know, careless driving, as I understand it, could be an accident. And I think from what I hear the proponents of the bill saying is that there's no disputing that this is probably an accident. That's how Representative Morrow characterized it. But we're deciding that in the case where there is an accident and the death results, we're going to have a different penalty. Am I wrong?
From Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. First of all, Madam Chair, thank you very much for allowing the authors a hearing on this bill. I greatly appreciate it. I want to apologize in advance for not making it to your graduation party earlier. I believe that was late last year, early next year. I actually had it on my schedule, but I was not able to make it over there. So I just, not that has anything to do with the actions of this committee today, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, I want to walk out here delicately because I'm not an attorney. I only went to law school for half a semester. I dropped out of William Mitchell, and I know that you have a more of a legal background than me, but it seems to me you're saying that the consequences of the behavior, we should not delineate criminal punishments based off that. And I mean, what you're saying is that you run a red light, there's a certain, you know, and an accident happens, there's a set of problems. You run a red light, there's an accident and someone dies, that you're having a problem with the effects of that crime. And I guess we do that in statute all the time. I'm not understanding it right.
We do that. Maybe I can
explain,
Madam Chair. That is taken care of in the sentencing portion of any crime. Once we determine that a person is culpable of a certain crime, then we look at how bad it was, and we sentence based on that. So, for example, a misdemeanor is up to 90 days in jail or a $1,000 fine. If it's really bad, we're going to give you the full 90 and full $1,000. 99% of cases, we don't give the full amount. We hang that time. What this is doing is this is saying, no, based upon the result of the crime, we're going to have it be an entirely different crime, which is why I asked the question.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Garofalo.
And Representative Lesch, I guess I don't want to get into hypotheticals and remind the committee that the committee essentially passed the same bill last year. I want to be respectful of the committee's time. But if somebody walks up and punches somebody, and they hit their head on the curb, that's an assault. They walk up and they punch somebody, they hit their head on the curb and they die, that's manslaughter or murder. And you are basing the sentence, the crime you are charging with, based off the effects of that action. In both situations, you have identical behavior. So I don't see the difference, but again, I'm very delicate about walking out here into criminal law. I think that the committee acted on this legislation last year. I think it is reasonable. We're only talking about when somebody dies.
Okay.
And so.
One more Representative Lesh, and then Representative Owen wants to have a.
And if I could, I appreciate that, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, but your description of that is an intentional act. And the way we've characterized something like a criminal vehicular operation is it involves alcohol or whatnot, which by operation of law, we have decided is an intentional act. You decide to get drunk and go out and endanger a family of six in a minivan or something. This is a situation that everyone admits is an accident. And some accidents are really bad. And I want to find out, is there a special justification why in this instance, when I accidentally run a red light because I failed to pay attention and I injure someone to the point of death and they die and their family is suffering. In another instance, there is no one there. I am guilty of completely separate crimes, one being a gross misdemeanor, one being a misdemeanor. That's my question.
I guess, Madam Chair, just to that Brockla. Point, my apologies, but Representative Lush, actually, under current law, we have that standard. There's a felony standard, and there's no intent with the felony crime right now. So the argument you're making, what we're trying to do is provide a third option. We're saying there's something between A-ball and Major League Baseball here. There is a third way in between just involving when somebody dies. There is on the books a felony crime where even if there is no intent, you can be charged with a felony.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I was just going to probably take off on what Representative Garofalo is saying. There is a felony crime on the book right now. The problem with the felony crime is that it's requiring some grossly negligent. It's a higher standard, which is hard to define. And right now, when you're what several county attorneys and other people are faced with is you either have to spend the taxpayers' money trying to prove criminal vehicular for grossly negligent, et cetera, or to take a simple careless driving, which really doesn't fit a death. So there is a need badly for a division between those two.
All right, Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, I'm just going to say I've supported this law ever since it came up a number of years ago, and I really don't consider this. They don't call them accidents anymore, by the way. They call them crashes because they don't consider anything an accident that happens on the road that results in a crash. There's always something that somebody did wrong. But this one is careless driving. It's not an accident. It says a person who drives, operates, or halts a vehicle carelessly, heedlessly, or in disregard. So I think the statute makes sense, and I think it's deserved of the punishment if it results in death. And it's like any degree of crime, criminal sexual conduct, enhanced, you know, the more serious it gets. And I think it makes perfect sense, and we should pass it.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing that, Representative Bigham.
First off, I just want to say I was at your party, and it was a wonderful party, Madam Chair. And this was the following groups, just to name a few, do support this: Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Abate, St. Croix Valley Riders, and the County Attorney Association. And just today, there was a letter passed out from the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office.
All right.
I appreciate your support. We all would appreciate your support.
Representative Bigham renews her motion that House File 2888 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bigham, Representative Morrow, and Representative Garofalo. Representative Mullery, you are all of the final bills on the agenda. So, Representative Mullery, do you have a preference on which one you take up first?
Number...
All right, Representative Mullery moves that House File 524 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this is, we heard it last year, and it proceeded to the floor of the House, I believe. It went to Finance. Well over half of the people in the county jails have diagnosable mental illnesses, and most of these individuals also face chemical dependency, homelessness, many other barriers to reentry into their communities. And leaving these unaddressed, obviously we have a lot of recidivism all over the state, but especially in the inner cities. This bill will could create a funding for a two-year county jail discharge planning projects throughout the state. Such planning is a nationally recognized best practice, and it helps reduce recidivism. There's all kinds of studies on that. It connects inmates before they're released to housing, employment, or income support, health coverage, meds, health care, mental health and chemical dependency treatment, transportation, and other barriers to reentry as identified therein. Even though we know discharge planning work, only a handful of Minnesota counties have actually started these programs. And I'm first speaker is Anna McLafferty from the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anna McLafferty, the Criminal Justice Project Director at NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I'd just like to say that NAMI Minnesota strongly supports this bill. Every day we receive phone calls from family members whose loved ones are in jail, often as a result of their mental health symptoms, mental illness symptoms. And most of these callers express the same thing when they call us, that their family member has gotten involved in the criminal justice system and they need help to stop cycling in and out of jail. We have a few testifiers here today to talk about how well jail discharge planning works to address this problem and how much more we need these problems or programs in Minnesota. First to Jeff Polreese from the Stearns County Sheriff's Department.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Jeff Polreese, Stearns County Jail Program Resource Coordinator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for letting me speak on this issue. We at Stearns County started a RAP group, Release Advanced Planning. It's the same type of group these individuals are talking about. We started in 2003. We've been doing it ever since. We didn't have any funding whatsoever, so any funding that could come the county's way would be very beneficial. So far, we've wrapped or dealt with 164 inmates. The recidivism rate that we reduced those people coming back for is 79%. And these aren't your atypical inmates. These are inmates that have been in and out of the system 30, 40, 50, 60. One was 257 times. So a 79% recidivism rate, that's pretty huge in my book. All the people we deal with are the people they're talking about. Mental illness, 65% of them. TBI, homelessness, unemployment. I mean, we're dealing with some of these major issues on a no budget whatsoever. We had $4,000, period, since 2003. So we're working miracles on a bootstrap. So a little bit of funding would really impact the help we can give these people and stop them from coming in here, the ER, detox. They're a better citizen. They're a better parent. It's a holistic approach of solving the problem.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was at the NAMI conference last fall, and one of the seminars was on this, and they explained the results, and I couldn't believe the statistics from the Stearns County Project. It's vastly, as some of you know, MacArthur Foundation has funded some studies of these specialty courts, and the Chief Justice has been very involved with that. And the Chief Justice had a half-day presentation last fall on the specialty courts and the MacArthur Foundation and their results, which they claimed were great. Well, the St. Cloud's, Stearns County results on this are just like something like eight times as good. So we have some results, but they really working in Minnesota, but we need some money for the programs to be expanded. And
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Molly, to your testifiers, do you have some paperwork just to give us some on this RAP deal? Okay, it would be.
Someone makes copies. I brought everything. I got the names off, so don't compliment.
That'd be great. I'd love to see some of that that information.
All right. If you'd get the paperwork to the pages, they'll get some copies, and we'll get them to the committee. Further questions from members? Draskowski, Representative Draskowski. Sorry, I drew a blank for a moment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't remember where your invitation your party is either.
Just I believe you received one, Representative
Draskowski. I did. I was just joshing you. Just curious, Representative Mallory, what what the blank appropriation here, what level of grants are you considering, or what, I know this is a fiscal thing for a Representative Paymeyer's committee, but any ideas?
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, no certain amount. You could maybe.
Any specific amount, I really would be. Any amount would be better than no amount.
All right.
Like I said, we had $4,000. We spent $2,000 of it. All the work that we're doing at Stearns, we're doing on county time. So it's costing labor costs. And thank God the people in charge there realize the value of it, so they're letting these people spend 1 hour a week helping these people. So there's costs there. Additional costs would be backpack, shampoo, a wind-up alarm clock for the people sleeping under the bridges. It's toothpaste. It's bus tokens so they don't get DARs trying to get to their probation officer. It's a lot of small costs. It really isn't very costful. Of the 164 people, if they're making copies of that form, potentially just at Stearns we save $1.2 million, almost $1,300,000 in potential costs just at our jail, not counting the impact it had at all the other places, you know, in the systems that people go to. So $10,000, I really don't know, but anything would be helpful.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stearns County testifier. Are there other counties that are doing this here in the state?
Yeah, we started in 2003. Probably about 2-3 years ago, I'm a member of the Minnesota Jail Programmers Association. We have a conference. Stearns County, I represented our group, and we won the state award for that. A lot of other programmers are there, and they all went, wow, that sounds good. It's about time we all do something right. So after that, word of mouth was going around. So I think there's probably about 18 counties. You know, the list that's floating around is 13, but I personally know there's a couple other ones because Stearns County held a mock rap where we invited every county to Stearns, and we role-played, and we showed them exactly what we're talking about. Plus, we've gone to like 8, 9, 10, 12 counties and talked to their groups individually. So I could volunteer my time. I'm sure Jen, there's another lady here that's really good with rap too. We love to help people. I would be willing to help any county start a group.
Okay, I've got Druskowski, Szymanski, and Anderson. So you're off. Okay, so Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What type of research has been done to show that this is effective? Maybe I missed this in the presentation, but do we have some very proven results here or not?
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, St. Cloud, I know him. I saw their statistics when I was at the NAMI conference last fall.
Okay.
And
So Representative Mallory, maybe you could just get us a copy of that, you know, after today so that we can all see if this is going to Representative Paymeyer's
right.
committee to talk about money and
Madam Chair,
and things.
I didn't realize the finances was all going to come up today.
That's okay, Representative Mallory. Representative Szymanski, a follow, or Representative Druskowski, a follow-up. Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mallory, is this program being used in other states, and are they seeing the same results? Are the same results happening as what your testifier just said from Stearns County?
McLafferty?
The answer is, Madam Chair, the answer is yes. It's being used in various forms throughout the country. There are kind of a few counties here and there that are doing this type of program. And my impression is that Stearns County is seeing some of the best results. I don't believe any other programs have talked about a 79% reduction in recidivism. So we brought Jeff here today to talk about this particular model as being particularly effective. And getting to the point of how much it might cost to start kind of bringing in these programs statewide, I would think a bill of about $100,000 would even be helpful to help several counties start programs like this.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, do you have statistics or a paperwork again to show other states and other counties or within that area?
Ms. McLafferty.
The National Gains Center with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration does have statistics on that, and I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
It would be great to see it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mullery, I'm going to ask that you wrap this one up because you have 20 minutes to finish the next two bills, and because there's somebody in here after us. Well, Representative Mullery.
We were ready to wrap up about 15 minutes.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 524 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery moves that House File 2607 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was supported by just about everybody I can think of, all the juvenile justice coalitions, JJAC, all of the probation organizations, and Mr. Sari is here as the head of the overall probationer and corrections officers in the state. This is one that I came upon, and we already have it in Minnesota rules. I believe it's 19.11. But we all we need to put it in statute. At when I was at the NCSL Juvenile Justice last fall, they mentioned that this is federal government is specific about certain things having to occur in order to get some of our funds from them, and this is one of the ones that I believe is required in order to get the funds in the future, and we're already doing it, so this is just putting what we have in rule into statute.
And Representative Mullery, is your testifier here to answer questions, or do you want to make a statement?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may just make a statement on this. My name is Cal Sari. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association. We asked the legislative staff to pass around to you prior to this meeting in your material today a little pamphlet of material from the Minnesota Corrections Association, which contains our legislative agenda. And I'd just like to make note of that and ask you to refer to page 14 of that, which deals specifically with this legislation. And as Representative Mullery has pointed out with this, there's confusion over this language. It is in the rules of Minnesota, Rules of Juvenile Procedure 19.09, kind of alluded to that with this legislation. The problem we run into is it's not in statute. There have been some issues with, particularly with jail administrators in greater Minnesota. So to clarify that issue, we'd simply like the rules put in the statute.
The pages have not yet passed around the pamphlet that he held up, members, so it will be coming here in just a moment. All right. Please continue if you have anything.
Okay.
Else.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This statement that we have that you'll get in this material simply gives a little bit of background about the extended juvenile jurisdiction statute, which some of you may be very familiar with and which we support and has been very important to the system. But as I say, the language and the rules are very, very clear with that, but we still have run into some issues around the state with getting jail administrators to accept 18-year-old offenders who are under extended juvenile jurisdiction. This simply clarifies what's in the rule and the word language you can notice in the proposed legislation is may, which still allows for the court to make decisions and using discretion as to who should be detained where and when.
Questions from members? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First question I have, of which may be several depending on where we're going here, is you get the, and I used to be a prosecutor for 32 years, and we did use the extended jurisdiction every once in a while, and sometimes it was on clients or prisoners, young people that committed crimes with dangerous weapons and minor other things that didn't get sent to prison because we were going to give them the chance. And now you're saying in this law that those people, if they commit another crime with a dangerous weapon, they're just going to be held in a shelter home, which anybody in his right mind can walk out of? I don't get it.
Representative Mullery or Mr. Sari?
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, I don't believe that's the intent of this. The intent is the opposite of this. to go into the legislation is that we have a person that's on extended EJJ supervision, and they commit another crime and are coming in on a revocation hearing with already over 18 years of age. We would prefer not to have them held with minor juvenile offenders in juvenile detention facilities, but rather have the, allow the court to have jurisdiction to hold them in the adult facility since they're 18.
Representative Olin.
Yes, I understand the the second provision of B probably does that. The first provision says distinctly, if the offender is under 18 years of age and is detained prior to revocation, may only be detained in a juvenile secure facility. That's the person under 18. That's the one I'm referring to that's dangerous out there that we gave a chance to, and all of a sudden now he's going to walk away from the secure facility. Where is he going next? What's he going to do while he's out?
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, that has been an issue that has come up before. In our proposal from this language, we're simply following the rules of criminal procedure that have been established.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sari, I guess one concern I have, is, and that might be what Representative Olin is getting at, is this is a mandate, again, on the local units of government, and I know that the cost of jails and the related incarceration decisions that are made by county governments are getting to really cash-strap these county governments immensely. One of the questions I have is related to the federal funding. Can you tell us exactly where this federal funding is coming from, which program it is?
Mr. Sari.
Madam Chair, Representative Drzewski, I'd refer to Mr. Mulry on that. Frankly, I'm not familiar with the funding for this. As far as a mandate being concerned that you make reference to here, you'll notice in the language in this legislation, it says may be detained. It still is discretion to the courts. What we're trying to put into the language that's here, according to the rules, is to clarify for those court administrators, particularly with those under EJJ jurisdiction that are over 18 years of age, that they may be held in adult facilities. That has been the issue that we're running into around the state. Not so much the mandate, but simply to clarify the issue for jail administrators, for the judges, and for court services people, that these are the options that you have.
Hello, Representative Druskowski.
The funding question, is there...
Representative Mulry.
And Representative Druskowski, I can't remember what the name of the program is. That was a few months ago. I would have to contact NCSL again to find out what specific program, but I know there was two or three things that they were requiring states to do for juveniles, and I just can't remember even the other two. And as far as a mandate, this is already in the rules, so they're already supposed to be doing it, so it's not certainly not a new mandate.
Representative Anderson and then Representative Olin.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mulry, if these were rules that already are in place and all you want to put it in statute, what's going to make the judges adhere? If they don't adhere to the rules, what makes them going to adhere to the law?
Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Sari said, some places may not know the rules or something like that. He's head of the overall corrections and all of the probation officers, so all of those feed up problems to him, so he's aware of them. He thinks, and the association completely supports this. I don't think there was a single contested anybody that didn't agree with this.
Okay.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm still having trouble with the under 18 that is in the statute. Because in greater Minnesota, the other factor that enters in is juvenile secure detention facilities or shelter care facilities aren't on every corner of the street. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, one officer having to be called in because there isn't anybody else on duty to start with, we're supposed to deliver somebody to the nearest shelter care facility under this because we can't detain them in our local jail?
Representative Mulry?
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, I believe that's in the rules right now.
Representative Olin.
Sir, I hate to disagree with you on that, but I know for a fact we've had to do this because we don't have any choice in northern Minnesota because of distances and times and number of people on duty. And it's been allowed by our judges.
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, I totally agree with you. I'm from northern Minnesota myself, from the Iron Range. We've had that same issue before, and that's done on an individual, you know, basis where you're at. Judges have made that decision. This rule doesn't change anything. It still leaves the courts to have that discretion to make that decision.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 2607 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Last bill, Representative Mullery, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on several juvenile justice task forces, and along with county attorneys, probation, public defense, and it came up that there's a number of youth that are fleeing and have been adjudicated, and they don't understand that it's affecting their rights later. Basically, it's what effect it has on jobs through our collateral sanctions laws, where we prohibit people who have been adjudicated or convicted of certain offenses to be even licensed later and or hold certain types of jobs under our law. It's called the collateral sanctions laws. And so basically all of these organizations from, I know, this has been a big issue with probation. I know the county attorneys are part of the groups that I'm on. I'm not on JJAC, but I go to some of their meetings, but the Juvenile Justice Coalition and things like that, to require that in court, before somebody enters a plea, that they be informed that it may affect their ability to be licensed or have a certain jobs in the future, and that they should check into that before they enter the plea. And so that's all this is doing, is just having the court advise them that they should check that before they enter a plea.
All right. And Representative Mullery moves that House File 2618 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Is there questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, how is the judicial branch or people within the judicial look at this bill as far as affecting them?
I've only talked to a few people that were, and I can't remember their names. There's judges that are on some of these coalitions and other judges that come to the meetings. I believe this was brought up at the Juvenile Justice Legislative Coalition that Judge Quaintance, who is the Chief Judge of Juvenile in Hennepin Court, was at that meeting. I'm pretty sure this was brought up there. It's about a 10-second statement, so it isn't going to have a lot of effect, but it will have a huge thing, because right now a number of juveniles don't know that this may affect what they're planning for their future. Most people that are juveniles, and a lot, even unfortunately, a lot of adults don't realize that if you're convicted or adjudicated on certain charges, you can no longer be licensed in the future. And so it seems fair that you should at least be informed. You should look into that.
Will this require
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will this require extra people in the courtroom or extra people in the process of making this, putting this law into effect?
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, though, the judge can say it in maybe 5 seconds, maybe 10 seconds at the outside.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Questions from members. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renew. Mr. Hazy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Council on Crime and Justice. I know you're trying to get through this, so I'll be very brief. I wanted to just give one story that in our role in some of our programs and advocacy at the Council on Crime and Justice, we often hear from young adults, parents, probation officers, wondering why this juvenile who had made a mistake as a juvenile now can't do X, Y, or Z. And one quick story is I got a call from a city police department psychologist who had worked with a young woman who stole a bike out of an open garage, a garage that was attached to a house. And that was charged as felony burglary. And this young woman then, that was her only offense as a juvenile. She went on, became a successful young adult, went to school to become a nurse, only to find out when she was starting to do her clinical programs in nursing that juvenile record is accessible by the Department of Human Services. This is what Representative Mullery was talking about. She is disqualified from nursing for 15 years in the state of Minnesota. She didn't know that. And I wouldn't want to discourage her from going into a nursing program. There is, as long as it's not a permanent disqualification, which this is also an issue for those offenses, but she can be eligible for a set-aside, but that may be difficult to get. It's not guaranteed. However, I think if even the prosecutor knew more about this, I don't know that all prosecutors understand some of these collateral sanctions or judges or defense attorneys. If they had known that, they could have maybe charged it differently, had the same penalty for that child, and then allowed them to be a more successful adult. So that's what Representative Mullery is trying to address here. I think it's a great idea. Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Sari.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add to what Mr. Hossie just said here, we don't have this in the Minnesota Corrections Association as a position paper, although we have been very active in the Collateral Sanctions Committee that worked a couple of years ago, and this is where this legislative proposal emanated from. And we hear those horror stories like he talked about week after week from people who have had bad experiences. I'll just share one quick example with you that just kind of shocked me, of a father that called me here early last fall from outstate Minnesota, who was vividly upset about what had happened to his son, who was a high school senior, had been involved in with no prior record of any type or any involvement in the criminal justice system, had been involved in a felony level criminal case, was charged, and when he was sentenced in court, received a stay of adjudication and was promised that this would not be held against him so long as there was no further convictions of any type. Well, this person then got off of probation based on the sentence of the court, had applied and did receive an athletic scholarship at St. Cloud State University, and being in the internet technology world that we live in, those records are always there, whether it's a state adjudication or not. Someone picked that up at the university level, and this person lost their full-time scholarship to St. Cloud State over that. And that's one example of just the collateral sanctions. We hear those kind of stories day after day, and this legislative proposal would be an effort to address that by simply having a forum to clarify for parents and for the juveniles that are coming through the system. These are the potential hazards that you're going to face from convictions in juvenile court.
Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 2618 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. Members, Representative Kaff moves the minutes of Tuesday, February 9th. Any questions or concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Kaff moves the minutes of February 16th. Any corrections or concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.